This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I just decided to sign it out.
Useful Idiots.
I did the U and the I, yeah.
Okay.
For those of us just listening, I traced a U and then I traced a vertical line.
It wouldn't be a very good looking symbol, I don't think.
Oh, like a U, like this. Yeah, it would look like a pitchfork or a tuner.
It could look at a lot of things, none of them positive.
Right. You want to hear very quick? Well, and this is Matt Taibbi.
I'm Matt Taibbi, by the way.
Yeah. Want to hear a very quick story about a tuner? So my uncle, my mom and I were visiting my uncle. He was in he had surgery. So he was in a rehab center and we were visiting him and he wanted a guitar tuner because he had a guitar and he played the guitar. And he also wanted to get stuff from the deli. And he wanted pastrami. So we came with the tuner and then the pastrami sandwich. My mom got a tuna melt. I don't remember what I got. I think maybe I got a tuna melt too. So we're sitting there with my uncle and he goes, "Can I have the tuna?" And my mom was like, "You want a pastrami?" I was like, "No, he's talking about the tuner." But he had a thick New York accent, so.
Right. I get it. That's good. Yeah. What do you think the percentage chances that Alexa will tell us a good joke if I ask her right now?
I don't want to get anyone's hopes up, so I'm going to say 50.
Alexa, tell us a joke.
Why couldn't the basketball stay in a relationship?
Because it was always bouncing around. Rebound. Oh.
What did it say?
Because it was always on the rebound.
I'm going to vote no on that one.
Can we give her one more chance?
Alexa, tell us a joke.
Why did the plane land on the football field? To score a touchdown.
Ugh. Why did the plane land on a football field to score a touchdown? All right, one more chance. We got to maybe.
Alexa, tell us a joke.
What do you call a boomerang that doesn't come back? A bummerang.
A what?
Bummer something?
A bummerang? Like what? Bummerang? A bummer? Oh my God. Alexa, you're fired.
So lots of stuff to go over this week.
None of it good, as you said. And we have a great guest, too. Oh, we don't announce the guest at the beginning, right?
No.
Okay.
No, we've gotten out of that habit. So let's just get into it. Four food groups. You're up, right? Democrats
suck? Yeah, I'm up. Yeah. So, yes, Democrats suck. For Democrats suck, let's just go to the videotape and check out a statement, a lovely moment with Jen Psaki Bomb Psaki.
The Biden administration considering extending that student loan payment pause. I know there's, if not, besides legislation that probably won't pass, what are some of the options that can help these people?
You're talking about the student loan payment pass that expires in February, just for clarity. So,
no, the other one.
In the coming weeks, we will release more details about our plans and we'll engage directly with federal student loan borrowers to ensure they have the resources they need and are in the appropriate repayment plan. We're still assessing the impact of the Omicron variant, but a smooth transition back into repayment is a high priority for the administration. The Department of Education is already communicating with borrowers to help them to prepare for return to repayment on February 1st and has secured contract extensions with loan servicers. So we are preparing for a range of steps here. These steps have provided, I would just note, more than $12.5 billion in discharges to nearly 640,000 borrowers, plus tens of billions more saved by the 41 million borrowers who have benefited from the extended student loan payment pause. But it expires February 1st, so right now we're just making a range of preparations.
And then on the Olympics,
So, okay, the answer to that question, Matt Wilson, can you play just the very opening of that clip?
The Biden administration considering extending that student loan payment pause. I know there's, if not, besides legislation that probably won't pass, what are some of the options that can help these people?
So they're asking, is Biden considering extending the student loan forgiveness, right?
Yeah, the payment pause.
Is he considering extending the payment pause, right? And the answer, you can't really tell. You wouldn't be able to tell from the minutes.
I fell asleep in the middle of the answer.
Right?
So.
So, yeah. Well, let me tell you what the answer is. It's a big fat no.
Right.
But yes. I don't think she actually ever says that. She says he will. They're resuming. What? I can't remember the word she says. Does anyone remember? Well, you were asleep. Wilson, do you remember the word she says at the very end?
Nope.
Can we play the very end of it? It's just like literally the last 10 seconds. It's
like our Carlton the Doorman.
Who is it?
Carlton the Doorman.
Don't know that. Who's that?
He is a sitcom character who is heard but not seen and has
What sitcom?
I think it's The Facts of Life. Not The Facts of Life. The Valerie Bertinelli one. Carlton the Doorman's from Rhoda, isn't it?
Yeah, Rhoda. That's is that her? Is it Valerie Bertinelli? No, it's what's her
name? No. That's not Valerie Bertinelli.
I know. What's her name?
I don't remember what her name is.
This is like the Senior Olympics.
Yeah, it is.
Name
it
that whatchamacallit.
In any case, the point was that Wilson is our sitcom character who is he's the amusing comic relief who appears sporadically, for an easy laugh.
Right.
Does that make sense? Wilson, yeah, you're not offended by that, are you?
No, it's the best praise I could have gotten from a boss.
Excellent. Yeah. Valerie Harper, not Valerie Bertinelli. It was a Valerie, however.
It was a Valerie.
All right.
So play the last 15 seconds of this.
More than $12.5 billion in discharges to nearly 640,000 borrowers, plus not tens the question. Of billions more saved the by the not, 41 can you million borrowers who have benefited the from the extended student loan payment pause. But it expires February 1st, so right now we're just making a range of...
There. It expires February 1st, so that's the answer. Is he considering pausing it? No. Big fat no. But she never says no.
No, fuck you, but.
Yes, no, fuck yourself.
Yeah, no, go fuck yourself. But on the way, here are some things to consider.
Here are some things to consider that we're preparing for the pause.
Right.
We're preparing for the pause. What the fuck does that mean, by the way?
I don't know. And we're still assessing the impact of the Omicron variant. Like,
yeah. Well, like, what the hell could that impact be, except for maybe more of a pause?
I think what they're trying to say is we've already come to a conclusion that the Omicron variant isn't enough of a big deal to make us consider extending this pause.
Right.
So that's actually a reason why another reason why you should go fuck yourself. We want to make it sound like it's a reason we're still considering.
Right. So not fingers doing crossed, that. Students, maybe the Omicron strain will
maybe get- it will turn very deadly. Very,
yeah.
You know,
and then you'll be in good luck. Then you'll be lucky. You'll have lucked out. Yeah. Also, okay, I know we're not supposed to, but I'm a woman. It's better. So you can just nod, Matt, or shake your head or condemn what I'm saying as problematic. But what's with the, like, a lot of women do this, my friends included, and I'm not opposed to it, but I think it's a little weird for a White House spokeswoman, the press secretary, to wear something with holes in it, especially because can we look at her image again, Wilson? You see the holes that she has? I mean, they're not holes like they, it's not like it's worn out. They're intentionally designed. They're cut in. But it looks like if you squint, it looks, and it's a Navy shirt. Matt's trying not to laugh. It's a Navy shirt. And it looks like a cat or something with eyes. It looks like some creature. Do you know what I mean?
No, I have a totally different read on that.
Oh, what is it?
Those are gills. She's an alien, she needs to aerate.
Right.
You're right. So.
She's coming out as she's no longer hiding the guilt. She's alien, no longer
alien nation.
Alien nation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, so you know what? Now I really put my foot in my mouth because I just.
Ableist. They're very odd,
I'm
though.
I'm very ableist right now. I didn't know those were gills. Thank you for raising my awareness here, Matt.
They could be a variety of things.
They could be raindrops.
Windshield wipers. The eyes thing is pretty powerful once you look at it that way.
Once you see it that way?
Yeah.
In this case, what would it be? I feel like Wilson and Taibbi, you know better than I would do what creature that would be. Some kind of thing in a movie that I haven't seen, probably.
Yeah, I know who you're thinking of, though.
Right? With the eyes?
It's, there was also a video game called Rolling Thunder that featured characters who wore sort of hooded costumes that had eyes like that, I think.
Yeah. I knew one of you would know. It's, and for people just watching, it's like two raindrops.
It's not sexy.
No, it's
it looks more utilitarian.
Yeah, it says it says unsexy as you can get with holes cut out of something.
Right. Yeah, it makes that's why I was thinking gills right away.
Right. You're right, because it's not really a good fashion statement.
Right. It's like I needed to cut these in order to breathe.
Do you think she did it right before getting on stage? Like she was just getting, she didn't have time to take a breather.
Maybe it could be. We go back and look and see if she makes room. Yeah. You know, in some of the
other appearances, she does the shake thing, the grab and shake. I don't know how to describe it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, shifting to the more serious thing, like the student loan pause, this was going to be a bad look for the Democrats, almost no matter what they decided, because this started under Trump, right? So having not done a debt forgiveness program, they are now going to end a Republican instituted student debt, essentially quasi forgiveness program.
Trump must be laughing his ass off.
I don't understand why they don't come up with some kind of solution to this problem. I mean, having written about this subject so many times, it's such a massive thing in the lives of so many people. Like, apart from Medicare for All, this is the easiest major fix they could do to change. Well, actually, that's not true, because this really primarily impacts the lives of people who are college graduates. So you're not going to get votes, who already overwhelmingly vote Democratic anyway.
Right.
But they should do something about it. It's just amazing that they keep punting away opportunities to do something about an obviously bad system.
Yeah. And I bet there are people who are independents, who are parents of kids with debt, you know, who would like the idea that their kid doesn't have to struggle to make ends meet, be punished for trying to get educated.
I mean, they should also just do something about the whole system. And we've done a couple of shows about this, but the whole system that kind of enables these companies to engage in types of predatory lending that the system was never designed to allow.
Right.
So you can't give a credit card to an 18-year-old who has no credit history, expect really to get away with that. But you can give massive amounts of sort of extra student lending to that same 18-year-old under the guise of a student loan, you know, for expenses.
Right.
You know, and get away with it. But
yeah. Great look, guys. Great look, Dems.
Anyway, but yeah, you're right. Yeah, this is just yet another one of those things that's going to back up on, or it won't. Who knows? I don't know. I feel like my predictive powers are waning, like my memory these days. So,
well, that's good. You won't remember how embarrassingly off your predictions were.
That's a good point. All right. Yeah, for Republican suck this week, there was a lot of stuff to choose from, and look, the Mark Meadows thing was certainly food for thought. I want to wait for the whole January 6th investigation to blow over before I kind of weigh in on that, because, well, for a variety of reasons. But there was another thing that happened this week that just always drives me nuts about Republicans, because they do this every single time, and I understand why they do it, but it's just like, it's almost like the perfect definition of performative nothingness, which is quasi, maybe it's like semi-annual demonstration against raising the debt ceiling. They did raise the debt ceiling. Wilson, if you can look, bring up the Hill story about this, you can see that they actually did do this. Senate Democrats raised debt ceiling after filibuster deal, right? So this is sort of expected, and here's how it reads. Senate Democrats on Tuesday voted to raise the debt ceiling, bypassing a GOP filibuster as part of a deal struck by congressional leaders. Senators voted 50 to 49 along party lines to raise the debt ceiling by $2.5 trillion. Though GOP senators supported legislation last week setting up the simple majority vote, none voted for the bill to increase the debt ceiling. So in other words, this is actually not a small detail. This is annoying, even though this was something that everybody agreed to, essentially, right? Like they agreed to not put up a fight about this, but they voted against it anyway, just to have the appearance of more conflict. Right. When this would have been an easy example of, yes, we can actually work together, but right. You know, but we don't, right? We hear Mitch McConnell in the story, if you go down, saying every Senate Democrat is going to vote on party lines to raise our nation's debt limit by trillions of dollars. If they jam through another reckless taxing and spending spree, this massive debt increase will be just the beginning, he said. More printing and borrowing to set up more reckless spending to cause more inflation to hurt working families even more, McConnell added. Now, if you go back and look, you will find Mitch McConnell basically taking all sides of this position. Wilson, can we see the Mitch McConnell on why you have to vote yes on raising the debt limit?
As you know, we're moving toward the conclusion of this period in session. We have left to do the FDA user fee bill, the veterans bill from the House.
Can you pause it 1 second? Sorry. This is unrelated, but they look like a gaggle of monsters. Don't they?
McConnell to me always looks like a nun.
Yeah, it's true.
Can you imagine him with a habit on?
I mean,
He would look better than the Larry David version of Sister Mary Mengele in the Three Stooges movie.
Sister Mary, I don't know what that is.
You have to watch the Three Stooges okay. movie.
Unrelated which is, to Dr. Mengele?
It is related to it. You have to.
The Three Stooges did that? That's kind of.
It's the Farrelly Brothers movie. You just trust me. Oh. It's really, really funny. You should watch it.
And Larry right. David is related to it or no?
He's in it. He plays the sort of evil nun in the movie.
It's called Mr. Mary Mengele. Sister Mary Mengele. Okay, we got to watch that.
That's not the name of the movie. The name of the movie is The Three Stooges. But
got it.
Yeah.
The Farrelly Brothers did a movie called The Three Stooges, which features Sister Mary Mengele, mm-hmm. played by Larry David.
That's who's fantastic. Yeah, but he would have been a more convincing Sister Mary Mengele. Anyway, let's keep listening.
Democratic leader and I have been talking about what I believe will end up being a pretty robust package of nominations that will help the administration get up and get running, which has been, as you know, quite a challenge for them. So that really kind of sums up what we'll be doing here before we break. And I would mention one other thing, the Secretary of the Treasury, Senator Schumer and I had a good meeting this morning in my office to discuss the raising of the debt ceiling,
which we all know will need to be done. Okay. So that was before he took sort of mountains of shit for saying that. And then Wilson, if we could see the other version of his take on this.
Republicans are shining a spotlight on the reckless taxing and spending spree that Washington Democrats are riding behind closed doors.
Doesn't he sound like a hostage?
Pushing in all their chips.
It sounds like he can't fully open his mouth.
Temporary pandemic as a Trojan horse for permanent.
He's got a tarantula covered in peanut butter in his mouth.
Biden, who ran as a unifying moderate, is either powerless to stop them.
Like John McCain's arms, but mouse form.
An avalanche of crushing tax hikes that would hurt families and help China.
How does he not open his mouth so much?
America's healthcare decisions, childcare choices,
but move it so much.
Family finance.
I don't know. When we get that old, we'll find out.
Trillions upon trillions more in government spending when families are already facing inflation. None of this, of course.
Is he going to use the word penury, do you think? I bet not.
What word?
Democrats have
penury.
I thought you said pangolin.
They haven't.
No, not pangolin. Penury. From the start, pangolin also.
To use a party line fast track process to ram through the Senate this version of their vision of America.
Okay, dude, you can't read your own
sentence. Republicans will not help this unified Democratic government with its basic duty to raise the debt ceiling. This could not be simpler. If they want to tax, borrow, and spend historic sums of money without our input, they'll have to raise the debt limit without our help. This is the reality. I've been saying this very clearly since July. And I think our Democratic colleagues are finally getting it because now they're fumbling for bogus excuses. They remain confident they can spend trillions of dollars to remake the entire economy in a couple of weeks. But supposedly, they just cannot clear this much smaller procedural battle hurdle without Republican help. Really? Give me a break.
Once you spend the money, it's done. Like, right. You got to raise the debt ceiling. There's no choice. Not raising the debt ceiling is right. Suicide. Okay? Like, if you default on all that debt, you've already spent the money. If you don't borrow to fulfill the obligations, the next time you're going to have to borrow, which is going to be immediately, it's going to cost you a fortune more. So not raising the debt ceiling is not an option. It's not a political option. It's not an economic option. It's just not something that can be done. If you want to fight about spending, you have to do it when you're deciding what to spend. This is like somebody saying, "Oh, I'm going to control spending," you know. And again, we've talked about this before. It's not analogous to household spending, but
right.
But the thought is similar. Like, "Oh, I'm going to control spending by not paying my credit card bill." Like, no, you control spending by not spending, you know, like, and so they go through this dog and pony show every single time. Like, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling.
How could Dems nail them on this?
They can't, because everybody does it. That's the whole point, is that both parties inevitably spend tons.
Right.
So that both parties rely on each other to always raise the debt ceiling.
Right.
So in that sense, he does slightly have a point that it's kind of a conspiracy that between the parties to always do this, but they never follow through on defaulting, because that's asinine.
Yeah.
More importantly, they never follow through on cutting spending
right.
together.
Cut the Pentagon, right. guys. That's a big, right. big money hole, big money pit. It's like
the
a
whole-
boat.
It's just that this whole thing is just such a dog and pony show, and they're particularly bad about it, because if you listen to that first video of Mitch McConnell, like, he just accidentally blurts out the truth because he he's forgetting to lie briefly, like, oh yeah, which, you know, the debt ceiling, which we have to raise, because, you know, I guess maybe he's getting tired. He forgot to lie. Yeah,
he forgot his talking points.
Yeah, so, and then later on, someone's like, "Dude, you got to pretend that we are not going to do this."
Right.
And so he goes onto the Senate floor and is like, all right, "We're not. They're going to have to do this without our help." And then, of course, they do it with their help. That's the other thing, is they actually did work out a deal to, and it's just so frustrating. And the people who actually pay attention to this stuff, either they're going to be upset that one or the other party is spending too much or is not serious about cutting spending, or they're going to be upset that they're pretending to care about spending. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like just the lying about it doesn't really help anybody politically.
Right.
So anyway, that's my Republican suck.
Yeah. And how they do indeed suck.
And this goes back to their whole, it'd be one thing if this was just, if this were right after, well, even that didn't count. Like, you know, the historic budget slashing that went on under Ronald Reagan, which of course, when you go back and look, turned out to be offset by a massive payroll tax hike that ended up having, you know, consequences on generations of people. They, and was later presented as, oh my God, Social Security's broke. Wonder why that happened.
Yeah. It's
right. the whole thing is just infuriating, but this is just regular installment of let's pretend that we really are gonna do something about spending by voting to do a suicidal, you know, abrogation of our financial responsibilities. Like, ugh. Anyway, so what do we have? What do we have for?
Wait, isn't that weird? Yeah. So this, I thought, let me just be honest. Can we show the, or maybe we can surprise Matt actually. So at first I thought that this story, I read the headline and it says, I saw Delta flight, right? And I saw woman caught breastfeeding on a Delta flight is what I saw at first. And I was really angry about it. But then I noticed that the words between breastfeeding and on a Delta flight were her hairless cat. So woman caught and this is a great story and shout out to the New York Post for providing it. Woman caught breastfeeding her hairless cat Delta flight. A Delta passenger was recently caught breastfeeding her hairless cat in a Delta flight from Syracuse, New York to Atlanta, Georgia, and ignored the repeated pleas of a flight attendant to put it back in its bag. A message which was then sent to alert the Delta crew in Atlanta of the situation has been shared on social media. And it says,
passenger in 13A is breastfeeding a cat and will not put cat back in its carrier
when flight attendant requested. Newsweek reports that flight attendant Ainsley Elizabeth, who was on board during the incident, took to TikTok on November 13 to explain more of what went down. This woman had one of those like hairless cats swaddled up in a blanket so it looked like a baby. Her shirt was up and she was trying to get the cat to latch and she wouldn't put the cat back in the carrier and the cat was screaming for its life. Yeah, this is where it gets into, isn't that terrible too? Yeah.
But. What? That's not already terrible? Okay, good.
Well, it was weird and then it was terrible. If the cat was into it, it would be just weird. The incident left the internet horrified. Such an ugly cat too. People removing their shoes during a flight is off-putting enough, but breastfeeding a cat, the seals of the apocalypse continue to loosen. Yeah. Has anyone tried unplugging humanity and plugging it back in? Can you imagine being on that flight? I mean, I feel the woman needs help.
I think there should be an airlock where certain passengers should just be released into the sky.
Yeah, maybe. The cat would probably appreciate it. I mean, that cat needs to be rescued also.
Right? Yeah. And what's the pathology of a person who not only has that weird paraphilia about breastfeeding a cat, but has to do it in public?
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean,
like, what goes on in private?
I don't even want to know. I hope that cat was freed, though.
I just thought of like eight things that were really, really, really terrible.
Share. Can't even.
No, I won't. I won't. But I'm sure everyone's thinking similar things, you know?
Yeah, that's what she does in public, yeah.
Well, I mean, why are there not more severe consequences for that?
Yeah, she should, yeah. Well, I'm not, you know, I have problems with the carceral state, but I do think she definitely needs to be trained. There needs to be an intervention, no doubt.
I'm just trying to imagine a flight attendant walking down the aisle and looking over and seeing like a guy putting like strawberry jam on his dick and having a dog licking it or something like that. Like,
oh my God. Yeah.
What would you do in a situation like that? That would certainly be arrest, right?
Yeah. That would warrant arrest. Yeah. She's really pervert. She's, you know what she's doing? She's hijacking breastfeeding rights. Right.
Right.
Like because there are unfair restrictions on breastfeeding. So she's trying to dilute.
Right. Yeah. It's a trick. Yeah.
I mean, she's also probably fucking nuts.
Well, that's
maybe
true.
Maybe it's not a trick. But how dare she unintentionally weaponize breastfeeding rights to apply them to a hairless cat who doesn't want to breastfeed?
Also, why is the cat hairless?
That's just a thing. It was born that way. Although, you know what? It does open the door. It's such a weird thing. It kind of opens the door for weird. Now I'm victim blaming now. I was going to say for weird behavior, but that's not fair. You can't do that. Would she
part
do
of
that
her
to
thinks
a hairy
it's a baby.
Cat?
Yeah, right. Probably
would she do
not,
it to
right?
A furry cat? Maybe not. I mean, that is if that's a baby, that's like the ugliest baby. Well, I'm sure.
Yeah. Baby with claws.
Baby with claws and skinny. She clearly can't handle a hairless cat. Don't know if she could handle a haired cat. I think she shouldn't have rights to have any animals. This is a clear, the consent is clear. The cat is screaming. I don't know if cats can scream. What can they do? They can meow angrily.
Yeah, I think humanity needs to reintroduce some of those ancient, like, you know, exile traditions, like,
yeah,
you know, I'm sorry, we just can't have you in the community anymore.
we're gonna put the plane.
Yeah, or just put her in a barge, and you know,
yeah,
wherever you end up, as long as it's not here, it's fine.
Yeah,
you know,
or with cats, as long as it doesn't involve an encounter with cats or any animals.
Well, whatever it is, as long as it's not on our territory. Like,
oh, I see. No, I don't. What I'm saying? That's out of sight, out of mind. I won't permit that.
I see.
You can't be allowed to inflict suffering.
You're more worried about the cat. I'm more worried I'm more worried about myself in the situation. The
tribe. Yeah.
Yeah.
The human tribe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
If someone did that to Bodhi, I would kill them.
I don't think Bodhi would latch.
No. I mean, the cat didn't latch either. Bodhi would probably bite, actually. So I think the woman would have no, she'd already have a be disincentivized. Bodhi doesn't take shit from people.
Good for Bodhi.
Yeah.
Well, that was definitely weird. That was definitely weird. As usual, it's pretty hard to tell between weird and terrible.
Yeah. Let's go for your terrible.
Wilson, how are we categorizing this? Is this a public service message? Is it a joke? Is it what is it exactly?
I think it's public service message trying to be funny.
Right.
Trying to be relatable and cool and TikTok.
This is Jimmy Fallon featuring Ariana Grande and Megan Thee Stallion. They're doing this thing that is supposed to be, I guess, some kind of public service message about Christmas and wearing masks and getting your booster. Let's just watch it.
It was a mask Christmas.
What's up, y'all? It's Megan Thee Stallion, Ariana Grande, and Jimmy Fallon. Y'all know what time it is. It's time to get those boosters.
It was a mass Christmas. We stayed in the house. We covered our nose and covered our mouth. But it's Christmas time. We'll be in line for a booster.
Yeah, this part, Wilson's right. This part is weird.
Why are there no jokes? It's so serious all of a sudden.
It's no joke, yeah.
Because it's actually trying to seduce you through entertainment. They're back to back unmasked, which is not what they're supposed to be showing.
Well,
they're a couple, so it's okay.
I think it's a thruple.
Well, Megan's not there. We don't see her.
Shoot.
Oh, it's a catchy song. Oh my god.
Okay, wait, stop.
That's the Grinch, right? Dancing?
No, it's a person covered in masks.
Oh my god, I thought it was the Grinch. That's so scary.
No, good. Yeah, see, look.
Wait, I can't see it. Hold on, let me make this full. Oh, that's really scary.
That's like hashtag resistance porn right there.
That's really scary.
Right?
Whoa, I thought it was a Grinch dancing. Kind of looks like a Grinch, but it's just a person covered in a mask. It's so scary. Okay. Oh my god.
You know, you have mask ornaments.
Count. No more quarantine on the couch. Yeah. This year, hang that mistletoe. I'ma kiss everybody that I know.
This year's different,
you can tell. Take those howls and jingle bells. Put Purell on everything. Turkey, egg, now candy cane. Hey, ho, there's a good chance of snow. Hey, ho, somebody wipe Rudolph's nose. Ho, hey.
we'll be okay. Does Rudolph have COVID? He's playing chess with a dog, and then there's a masked creature.
That like Hall & Oates or something? Well, it's kind of a catchy song, I'm not gonna lie. I'm sure a lot of people are gonna lose respect for me.
I just feel it's just kind of cringe all the way through, though.
It's kind of cringe, yeah. Well, what's the message really? The message is what? Get your booster. We'll be in line for a booster. You're not selling it well. No one wants to be in line for it. You just want to get it. In fact, this is like anti-vax, anti-mask. This is anti-vax propaganda, unintentionally.
Unintentionally?
We'll be in line for a booster? Why are you emphasizing the line part?
I guess so. It's the creature covered in masks.
That's a scary thing, too.
That's a scary thing. Like, I don't want that fucking thing dancing in my house.
I know, seriously.
You know what I mean?
I think they did this. I think the song is catchy, but I think you throw in the masked creature. And then we'll be in line for a booster. And you're just.
And the bad jokes about getting Wi-Fi, as Wilson points out. Yeah.
I mean, not to say, I feel like kind of boomerish, but I kind of thought that was a cute little stupid joke. I'm really going to lose. I hope people don't unsubscribe to the show because of that. But I'm just being vulnerable and real.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That just is too cringe for me.
Yeah.
The dancing mask creature and the mask ornaments, and then the weird switching of the masks on Ariana Grande and Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, that's weird. So Jimmy Fallon's wearing a mask that has her face on it, the bottom of her face on it, and she's wearing a mask that has the bottom of his face on it.
Like, what's that supposed to mean?
Very weird, all of it.
And is the mask creature a fourth person, by the way?
Oh, I was wondering who's doing it. I think they just paid someone to do it. What do you think? I mean, anyone could have done it. The dance moves aren't that good, and they're all decent dancers. So
no, but nobody's gonna nobody that famous,
right? Is gonna do that.
Is gonna do that without their face showing.
At the last minute, they were like, "This is so scary and weird. I was gonna show my face, but let's just cover me up."
I can't have masks and boosters. I mean, that's like turning, you know, the Whams. I think it would have been funny if they had done Masked Christmas instead of Last Christmas. You know what I mean? Like as a spoof.
Yeah.
Although I guess, I don't know. You're right. I mean, it's a catchy song, but something about it freaks me out. Not an insignificant amount. So
they could have done, "I'll be masked for Christmas."
Are we ever going to not have to wear masks and all that shit?
I don't know.
I think that tweeter is right about unplugging humanity and plugging it back in again. All right. Well, that was our uplifting four food groups. And we're going to now turn to our mystery guest. So
yes. Yeah. Very excited to have joining us Christian Parenti, the author of several books, including Tropic of Capricorn. Wait. No.
Wasn't that Henry Miller?
Yes. Hold on.
Christopher, author of many books, including The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Moby Dick, Anna Karenina.
The Bible.
The Inferno.
Yeah, sorry. the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm. Roots.
Roots, yeah. The Diary of Anne Frank.
Right.
Yeah,
right. So another great Parenti work. Well, we can ask him about all those books. Yeah, I mean, look, it's gonna be hard to squeeze in all those. There's a lot of stuff to ask about there.
I know.
We forgot Meditations by that was when he was
by
writing
Christian Parenti.
Right. Oh, well, he was writing under the name Marcus Aurelius at the time.
Right.
But
right.
But that was another great book. Very influential. That is
very influential
back then.
All really great works. Oh, we forgot Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet. Well, that was in his dramatic phase.
Right. We're not focusing on his drama, his plays. Right.
I was always more a fan of the comedies than the tragedies.
Yeah. Are you there, God? It's me, Christian.
Waiting for Parenti.
Waiting for Parenti. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So Christian Parenti, for real, the former contributing editor at The Nation, the author of Lockdown America, The Soft Cage, and The Freedom, also The Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. And he contributes frequently to Jacobin and Nonsite.org. Nonsite is, of course, a friend of the show's Adolf Reed's site. It's a peer-reviewed online journal. And we're going to be talking to him about a new essay that he has at that site.
All right. Sounds good. Let's go to the video tip.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So excited to be talking to Christian Parenti. So excited to have you on the show to talk about, among other things, your recent article, The First Privilege Walk, which is at nonsite.org, which is, of course, the site founded by friend of show, Adolf Reed. And the subtitle of this piece is How Herbert Marcuse's Widow Used a Scientology-Linked Cult's Methodology to Gamify Identity Politics and Thus Helped Steer the U.S. Left Down the Dead-End Path of Identitarian Psychobabble.
That's an impressive subtitle, I have to say.
We'd have you on just for that.
Yeah, like, and that should get like a nomination for something.
It's like a 19th century style subtitle.
It's very good.
Subtitles would have like semicolons in them and go on.
Right. Exactly.
So what made you write this piece in the first place? Like, how did you even stumble upon this story?
Well, I was, as I say in the story, you know, when I was
one of the first.
I hitchhiked out to California from Vermont. Got a job moving furniture, and I had dropped out of college already, and there was this weird little college called the New College of California, which later folded, and that's a whole interesting story in and of itself. But so I enrolled in the New College of California, and it was a left-leaning, relatively inexpensive, progressive little place. And there, in my first semester in a class taught by an anthropology professor who had actually had lived with Foucault briefly, or had stayed in Foucault's like little next door apartment. We did this exercise, and it was I was sort of didn't quite know what to make of it, but it felt like it was avoiding, real radicalism somehow, but I couldn't quite at that point figure out what was wrong with it.
And for those who don't know, what exercise are we talking about?
Right. Yeah. So the privilege walk, which was, it was called at first the power shuffle, and sometimes it still is called the power shuffle. And this is an exercise beloved by social justice trainers, where a group of people stand on a line and then take a step forward or a step backward in response to a series of questions, such as if you've ever been made fun of because of your ethnicity or sexual identity, take one step backward. If you're a white man, take one step forward. And, any kinds of questions can be asked. And in the end, people are arrayed along a spectrum of privilege, and, discussion ensues.
Or
it doesn't ensue sometimes. Sometimes it's just sort of like, now look at this and take it all in. As if living in this society, you weren't every day bombarded by forms of inequality, sort of like supposed to be, oh wow. So that's what the privilege walk is. And the reason I wrote the article was because I did this in 1989. And then over the years, people would tell me, oh, I just did this exercise in law school. I got into law school and we did this thing or this, blah, 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 like different places. And I'd always be like, yeah, I did that. I did one of those. And then
I did it a union summer, by the way. I did it when I was doing union summer, which is an internship from that the AFL-CIO used to offer.
I won't ask you how well or poorly you did, but
I can't even remember. I just remember someone stepping. The one thing I remember was someone, they said, have you ever been made fun of for your weight? And this girl who was very thin stepped forward and I was shocked, or stepped backwards. That's the only thing that stands out for me.
Yeah. They should have referees in this, because like that's like, I don't know, but so yeah.
What would the referees' uniforms look like?
That's
a great rainbows.
Yeah.
Something cultish, like a black tracksuit and Adidas, maybe.
Right. Yeah. Shed your container.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it was weird. I actually started. I read the Helen Pluckrose book, Cynical Theories, and I was like thinking about reviewing it, and I started writing about this and looking into it, researching, trying to figure out where it actually came from, because I had a hunch that these people I knew were probably at the beginning, and sure enough, they were. So this professor of mine had learned it from one of the people who had invented it, who was named, she has since passed away, her name was Erica Sherover Marcuse, and she was a student of Herbert Marcuse's, and then later married him and was his widow. And so,
and can you just share, because not everyone is familiar with Marcuse, can you just give a short biography of him in a sentence?
It's going to be tough.
Yeah. You know. I mean, you know, a member of the Frankfurt School, kind of, you know, neo-Marxist German critical theory that was in the Frankfurt School, named for, you know, Frankfurt, Germany, where the research, the Institute for Social Research that they were all part of was housed there, and they were all scattered to the wind by the rise of Nazism. And the Frankfurt School was, the thinkers of the Frankfurt School were concerned with the question of subjectivity and how capitalist society, engineered consent. And they were most famously about mixing Freud and Marx to sort of move beyond the traditions of sort of classical Marxism that were at that point heavily rooted in, you know, political economy. And they were in many ways one of the opening acts of a kind of the cultural turn, as it later becomes known. I mean, now there's just, you know, a whole cottage industry in the kinds of cultural analysis that the Frankfurt School pioneered. And Marcuse was in many ways the kind of most left, because some of the Frankfurt School members, when the 60s come along, kind of like Adorno, there's Adorno, Horkheimer, Marcuse, those are the most famous, Eric Fromm is part of it. There's a bunch of other lesser known scholars who are part of it. And like Adorno sort of turns against the new left. He sees the new left radicalism as kind of dangerous and unhinged. And Marcuse in America becomes like the kind of a philosophical wellspring for new left politics. So he's helping infuse the milieu with ideas. And he's also, you know, responding to the whole moment and responding to the milieu. It's not like people are just like reading Marcuse and then doing things. It's like people are in and out of movements. There's a cultural revolution, there's riots, there's these radical movements, the civil rights movement has been victorious, and there's the rise of the Black Power movement, the Panthers, various other ethnic nationalist movements. The student left is becoming increasingly, or elements of it are becoming increasingly radical. So Marcuse is influenced by all that and influences it. And, yeah, and very, very importantly, he's quite cynical about the role of working classes in core capitalist economies. He sees them as having been too bought off, essentially, that even though they remain like a real class in that they don't own the means of production and they just sell their labor, that intellectually they're hopeless, that they're never going to be a class in themselves, a class for themselves. They're not going to develop class consciousness because they have had too many victories. And, you know, that wasn't entirely untrue. There was, you know, large parts of the industrial working classes in the West were pretty conservative and were doing quite well. But the great irony is that that was largely due to the fact that they had been so radical and so united and so disciplined, and they had won these gains. And then Marcuse dies in 76. And, you know, in the last couple of years of his life, there's already the opening acts of what we now call neoliberalism, right? This like this shift away from the intellectual consensus around policy that comes out of the 1930s, which is that, okay, capitalism has to be managed. There's going to be booms and busts. And there's, you know, regardless of any moral concern, there have to be programs to redistribute money to the poor so that, you know, the business cycle is, you know, flattened, that, you know, recessions aren't as bad. And there's a turn away from all that that begins in the 70s. And, you know, Pinochet famously in Chile is part of it. But the austerity in New York City during the fiscal crisis is one of the opening acts domestically. So even in Marcuse's last years, like an assault, a new and really vicious assault upon the gains of the working class are beginning. But so if you want to be charitable to Marcuse's cynicism about the working classes in core economies, you could say, well, he was commenting at really like the peak of living standards for that class. And he missed the worst of what was to come in the 80s, where there's just, you know, wholesale deindustrialization, breaking of unions, and, you know, the total transformation of regions like the Midwest, just like devastation as a result of policy that allows business to automate more radically and outsource and just close up shop and go away.
But he had become famous already for, you know, that book, One Dimensional Man, which essentially, I mean, I think you characterize it as describing the working classes as a little bit lazy, or they'd been essentially anesthetized by the consumer gains of, I guess it was then 1950s America, right? Then when he was writing that book, or early 60s maybe.
Yeah, I forget when One Dimensional Man came out, but.
But yeah. The idea was that the working class was not going to be sufficient by itself to achieve revolution. And so there needed to be a new coalition.
Yeah, and new revolutionary subjects.
Right.
And so that's like, that kind of opens the door for like, for
1964, identity, by the way.
You know? And there, an assumption begins, which is that somehow all of these identitarian struggles, which were important and, you know, were based in real grievances, that they would somehow add up to a force that could and would challenge the domination of capital, i.e. the domination of big business in the 1%. And in the ensuing decades, I think we see that's not true. It does not add up to that, you know, and in fact, it functions as a kind of ersatz left, as a kind of decoy left. Not that there's like some great conspiracy, but that there's a realization among policy elites in the 60s that opposition is never going to go away, right? That under capitalism, under really any class society, there's never going to be just total consent and social peace. There's always going to be resistance. And so the choice then is like, you know, if you know, as for economic elites, it's like, well, what kind of opposition would you prefer to have? People organized as workers who want higher wages, who want the decommodification of things like education and healthcare, who basically want to take your money and redistribute the wealth that society produces? Or would you prefer an opposition that's much more fragmented and is about ending discrimination, changing the way language works, that's ultimately making a set of cultural demands? Not that these cultural demands never have any material impact, they do, but they don't add up to give us the money, you know?
Right, it's a little bit more, as you described, a little bit more about etiquette and manners in some respects than, you know, money and power.
Yeah, part of the fallacy in all this is also that the, you know, for example, like racial disparities, that these are the result only of racist attitudes. And that's, you know, that doesn't really always pan out. James Forman Jr.'s excellent book, Locking Up Our Own, is good for this. And the book opens, he's a defense attorney, and his client has been sentenced to, and he looks around in the courtroom and everyone is Black. And the book then goes on to explain how, you know, a lot of African-American prisoners in America are sent to prison from cities that aren't controlled by white elites, but are controlled by Black elites. And that it would be wrong to say these prosecutors and judges and Black police captains are racist. They're not racist. They've in fact fought against white racism to get where they are. But that doesn't prevent them from locking up and making careers upon locking up poor Black people. And so the end result is racial disparity. And the incorrect assumption that a lot of people make is that that's always rooted in the mentality of people. And if you can change people's feelings and attitudes, then these policies are going to change. And, you know, Forman's, what he shows is that, like, you can change the entire personnel and you get the same outcomes. So there's something deeper and more structural than just the attitudes of people in these courtrooms.
And Forman is Black, right?
Yes.
He's
the son of civil rights leader James Forman Sr.
So tell us a little bit more about Ricky Sherover Marcuse and how this, because this is an amazing journey described in this article of how she came to have all these ideas, who else influenced her along the way. I mean, I think if it were more widely known, there'd be a lot of questions about some of these ideas, but could you talk a little bit about that?
So it begins, I mean, her father is an important character. I mean, there's a way in which this is a classic, you know, generational conflict. Her father's name was Miles Sherover, and he was born in Poland. He comes to America. He's orphaned, not orphaned, but his father dies by the age of 11. He's selling insurance door to door. He graduates from City College, and he's some sort of a lefty. Definitely in like the CP milieu, whether or not he was a member of the Communist Party, I don't know. He goes to the Soviet Union. He travels around. He does international kind of left journalism, writes some pieces for the New Republic. I think he writes a piece or two for The Nation. And then he is an efficiency engineer in the Soviet Union. So really like a real character. He then comes back to America and he becomes the first person to underwrite Soviet bonds. And very crucially, he becomes the Spanish Republic's purchasing agent. It's kind of like their guy in Washington on the economic front during the Spanish Civil War, when there's a fascist coup attempt within the army. And then there's, you know, the Civil War, and Nazi Germany and fascist Italy go to the support of Franco and his rebel forces. And the world embargoes the Spanish Republic, except for the Soviet Union and Mexico. And so Miles Sherover is in the U.S., and isolationists in the US Congress have passed laws preventing any aid from going to the Spanish Republic. And Miles Sherover Marcuse, with the knowledge of and approval of Franklin Roosevelt, and working closely with his brother-in-law, Gracie Hall Roosevelt, who has the same last name, even though he's his brother-in-law, because of course, Eleanor Roosevelt's maiden name was Roosevelt, because they were cousins from the two
cousins,
different
brothers. Yeah, it took me a while to figure that out. Then I remember they were cousins.
Class. They're weird. But to his credit, FDR is like approving these secret deals. Miles Sherover sends 30 shiploads of, you know, weapons and medicine and supplies to the Spanish Republic. At least one historian I quote says that his company, Hanover Trading, was central to keeping the Spanish Republic alive for 2 years. And then he's finally working on getting over 100 bombing aircraft shipped to France, but it's for Spain. And right wingers in the aircraft industry get wise to this and like, wait a minute, what is this? And so the whole thing blows up. And but like Miles Sherover went to the White House and met with FDR on this stuff. And he also facilitated the transfer of of German and Italian aircraft technology to the US, which was important in US preparation for the war, to study that technology. So then after the war, Miles Sherover goes to Mexico. He makes documentaries in Mexico, and he somewhere along the way, he acquires the rights to several Charlie Chaplin films. He sells the rights to these films, to The Great Dictator in particular, but he owns several others as well, to the Czech government for like 10 times the going rate for such a deal. He parlays that money into creating the largest private steel corporation in Venezuela. And then by the early 50s is splitting his time between Jerusalem and Caracas, and he endows the Jerusalem Theater. And so he's like,
he leaves his wife and kids, right?
That's right. And along the way, when he goes to Venezuela, he abandons his wife and his two kids, the eldest daughter being Ricky Sherover.
Erica's nickname is Ricky.
Right. That was her nickname. Her real name was Erica Sherover, and then Erica Sherover Marcuse. Ricky then, is educated in New York City. She goes to Oberlin College. And when she graduates, she goes to Israel and she spends time on a kibbutz and her father tries to come and see her. So there's clearly like this conflict between them. They eventually reconcile, from what I was told by family members. And so she is part of the new left. And this is she's in Israel in like 60 and 61. And she then comes back to New York. She enrolls at Brandeis, where Marcuse is teaching at the time. She becomes a teaching assistant of his. And then when he goes to UC San Diego, she goes with him. And Marcuse's second wife, Inga Neumann, I believe she passes away. And so Marcuse is widowed. And then a year or so after he's widowed, he and Ricky get together and then are married. And she writes a dissertation. I mean, Marcuse has passed away. He dies in 76. And Erica Sherover Marcuse writes a dissertation, does a dissertation under the guidance of Habermas, is how she finishes it. Habermas, who's still alive, was a Frankfurt School luminary. And she publishes that book, and it's called Emancipation and Consciousness. And it's a critique of Marx for not having a theory of revolutionary consciousness. And it's basically says that Marx, Marx
too materialist.
Yeah, Marx is too materialist. And so, it's very much in this kind of, the vein of what Herbert Marcuse was concerned with, and in the vein of what the new left across the West was concerned with, which was, transforming consciousness. How do you build revolutionary consciousness in the advanced capitalist core? And how do you, how do you throw off the soft and comfy shackles of consumerism and entertainment culture that, had been anesthetizing people?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
That was great, huh?
It was. That's an article after my own heart, honestly.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
I have him on for a while, and then that was just like, that was like made for you in a lab, that article.
But see, this is what irritates me about a lot of my own experience in the last 2 or 3 years. I don't particularly classify myself as a person of the left, although I clearly grew up, on that side of the spectrum, like an ACLU,
right?
Liberal, like, all that stuff. But to me, my immediate reaction to a lot of this sort of new left movements is that this was not leftism, that this was a corruption of something, that it's on some level, some kind of play. I couldn't like figure it out right away, but it seemed like, it's easy to see when you follow the Bernie Sanders campaign,
right,
that what he's asking for is very simple, decipherable, and
left,
clearly sincere, and clearly, yeah, has a left tradition, although I would say it's a much watered down version of,
right,
of the left, right? Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's you can easily understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
This other thing is not so simple to understand. And, you know, I think the degree to which just watching it even clash with the Sanders movement and interact with it in the last few years, and to see almost that it was hostile to the Sanders movement when it should have, if it was really left, it should have been deeply enthusiastic about it.
Right. Well, because they're not, yeah, because they're a bunch of corporate sellouts. So
anyway, I think this article is really interesting because it explains a lot, this idea of sort of psychologizing politics and diverting attention from the material side of things. We've talked about that with people like Adel Fried before.
Yeah.
That history makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
The more,
and
you know.
And it just also, it's so counterproductive. And whether or not you care about disparity or you care more about actual injustice and exploitation, you know, given how racism works and how our economy works, obviously when you address the exploitation and you increase people's wages, you're going to be disproportionately helping people of color.
Right. Right.
I'm just making the argument for people who have that view. No one gets thrown under the bus by mass class-based politics.
Not necessarily. No, I mean, the people who get thrown under the bus in mass class-based politics are the relatively 1%. Very few people who, you know, have way too much money, right?
Right. Like, and they don't even get thrown off the bus. They get put from like a first class seat. No, what's like the top of the first class? They get removed like once every 5 flights from a private jet or something.
Yeah.
They're fine.
Exactly. If it's the Sanders version, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about the Bolshevik version, it's a little bit more brutal. Yeah.
I think we need to threaten them with that. If only they thought that the alternatives were that or Sanders.
But for sure. And this is something that came out for me with the Loudon thing, is just when you let this loose on everybody, the immediate reaction is complete mayhem. Everybody hates everybody else and everybody blames everybody else. Like, it becomes impossible to even imagine organizing anything, you know, in an environment like that.
And we didn't even have time to get into this. We can talk about it another time. But one of the women who participated in this stuff and is now kind of like a right winger, uses the word globalist, was kind of like turned, I think, repulsed by some of those practices, and still rails against, still sees the 1% as the enemy, but now from the right, not from the left, because she was so turned off by this stuff.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. Anyway, great article. Highly recommend everybody read it. And rate, review. And
rate, review, subscribe.
And we will see you again soon.
Yep. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Hello. Thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
The Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.